Before we get started with this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Adore.fm, and ChiroRadio.com, and wherever else podcasts are available. Let's get started with the show. Hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 307, what is now officially a long and drawn out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Yes, indeed, folks. We've got a great show planned for you today. An amazing life story by a guy of the name Joe Gregory, who goes by Jay Gregory, and we're going to be featuring music off of his upcoming album, and it is some really, really good stuff. So we've got that. We've got an announcement to make that I've already made publicly, as I was the co-host of the Too Beautiful to Live TBTL podcast on Friday of last week, so go and check that out. One of my favorite podcasts. It was a it was an absolute honor to get to co-host that thing with the likes of Andrew Walsh. So go and check that out as well. We had a great time. Yeah. It's been a good weekend, man. It's been a really good weekend. It's been kind of weird, though, because of this announcement that I'm about to make here on the Air Raid Podcast. If you haven't heard it already, I have decided to end the show. That's right. The Air Raid Podcast is going to come to an end sometime late September. I just, you know what? It's gone on for over 6 years now. And it's just time to end the thing, man. And we've it's better to end it on top or in solid middle, as podcasts go, than it is to end it on bottom, right? And you know, with the things that have been happening in my family, health issues, and some other stuff, This show has been a source of anxiety, a source of stress for me, and I've decided that it's time for it to end. I've had the conversations that I've wanted to have, and we've still got more coming up for you. So we're not done yet, but in another month and a half or so, it will stop, man. And well, you know what? I'll say this. It will no longer exist on the plane that it currently exists on, right? Andrew had a great point on TBTL on Friday. He had a great question. He asked me if something came up, right? If like an artist came up that wanted to do an interview or something like that, would I post it onto the Air Raid website? I said, yeah, of course. I would totally do that. If it was something that like came up that was really piqued my interest, I would probably still do it. So the Air Raid Podcast will go on, just not like it is now. It will be very few and far between, and it'll not be something that's on a regular basis. Like I said, this is, you know, the more I do the show, the more stress is created, and I want to have time to spend with my family, and be present as a father, as a husband, and this show, as it goes on, is increasingly, or it's taking more and more of my time, and it's been fun, man. And that's not to say that the conversations that I'm going to have here in the future until we end the thing, or the conversations that I've had in the past, were not fun. I have a great time talking with everybody on this show, and it's always fun. It's always fun, except for, you know, that Junior Brown interview that went so sour. But it's always a good time. I always have a wonderful time learning about new music, finding out about new music, and talking to musicians that have been around the block, man. It's always a great time. This episode with Jay Gregory is one of those times as well. But lining everything up and doing it week in and week out for over 6 years has taken a toll on me, man. And you know, it's just time to break away, start something new. We do have something new in the chamber for the future. So, you know, keep your eyes peeled for that and stay subscribed to the Air Raid podcast, because there will be new stuff, you know, coming out periodically. And like I said, you know, we're still not done. We're still, you know, we're going to go through September. We've got some great things lined up for you there, but it's just time to end it. It's just time to end it. And I want to thank all of you guys that have stuck with us for so many years and been a part of the Air Raid podcast, listening to it, sending us your emails, donating to the show, which has really helped. You're just wonderful folks, man. And thank you so much for listening throughout the years. It's been a lot of fun. This show has taken me to so many places that I never thought I would be able to go to in my life. It's introduced me to people who, you know, not only that I have been fans of or a fan of for, you know, ever since I can remember, but it's also introduced me to new acts and new music and new actors, comedians, and directors and writers that I probably never would have gotten to meet or talk to if it wasn't for this thing that I started 6 years ago. It's been a wild ride, man. It's been a wild ride, but all rides come to an end, right? And this one is going to come to an end soon. So there's the announcement. There's the announcement. I did it. It feels weird, man. I was, after I made this announcement on TBTL the other day, it felt very strange, because I've been tethered to this thing, right? This podcast, this show, for over 6 years. Tethered to it. Like every time we go on a family vacation, I got to think about, okay, well, how am I going to get this show up, you know, while we're gone? Or can I find somebody to actually post the stuff while I'm away? You know, things of that nature. It's always kind of a little source of stress in my life that I don't really necessarily need right now. So thank you all who have listened to the show over the years. I love you, and I'm sorry that if I'm letting you down, but this is where I need to be in my life, and I'm already feeling really good about this decision. It's sad. It's going to be weird not doing the show, but for my family's sake, it is going to be a great thing, and we'll move on from there. Okay? All right. I'm starting to tear up a little bit. I'll wipe that away. A lot of dust in here, people. A lot of dust. It's been a constant thing. This show has been with me through death, through the birth of my children, through sickness, through health, and a lot of things in between, man. It's gonna be weird not having this like stable entity in my life any longer, but yeah, it's gonna be a good thing. It's gonna be a good thing. It's time to move on. It's time to move on. All right, we've got an amazing story for you guys. This guy Joe Gregory, originally from Seattle, played in multiple bands, moved down to L.A. to follow his his dreams of rock and roll, and he made it, and then everything kind of fell apart. And it's an amazing story, and I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. And like I said, there will be more Air Raid podcasts coming out throughout the next month and a half, 2 months. So, you know, stay with us, and you know, we'll continue to bring you. I'm not going to slack on this, guys. I'm not going to slack on this. So stay with us, man. Stay with us until the end, and then continue to follow us because there might be more stuff coming out, and there is another show in the works that I am going to be doing with a friend of mine. So I hope you guys stick with us for that one as well, and we'll make that announcement sometime soon. Okay, well, let's get into it, shall we? This song is by a band called Delure. The song is A Billion Odd People that came out back on the album Suburbiac back in 2002 by the band Delure. Joe Gregory was a part of this band, and I think he was still in the band at this time, so I hope I got this right. I hope I got it right. And then we'll be featuring some music, some new music by Joe throughout the rest of the episode. But this one is an old band of his out of Seattle, Delure. This one's called A Billion Odd People. And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears. Stay with us. You don't know them. They don't care. They don't care about you. Do you feel like that's like, yeah, of course I am.
Yeah.
What kind of a, oh God, I already lost it. What kind of a subject is that?
It's interesting. I think, you know, I used to have so much Seattle pride and I still do to a degree, but it's changed so much in the last couple of years, especially that, I'm feeling a little torn about my hometown.
Are you really?
I am. And a lot of it's more sadness. I know there's a lot of like, you know, there's a lot of emotions when development and growth happens like it's happening here. You know, but for me, it's like you drive by the Harvard exit and it's boarded up and it's like, man, that sucks. Like, how many movies have I seen there that were, you know,
integral
to my youth development, you know?
We were driving, Mairead and I were driving up on Capitol Hill, I don't know, a couple months ago. And we hadn't been down there for a really long time. Like, some of our close friends that used to live down there don't live there anymore.
Yeah.
And so we don't really, you know, I go down there for shows, but I'm only going to like the clubs that I know and you know, know how to get there. And that's about it. But, we ended up on this corner and it was just like, wait a minute,
where are we? Like, all of a sudden didn't know where we were at all.
Yeah.
Like, it had changed so much in just, like, a period of, like, 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. It's weird. You'll, like, drive down the street, and then the next day this huge building will be gone, and there's, like, this giant hole in the ground, and you're just like, dude, where are we? It's so weird. But then they're replacing those holes with all these, like, homogenous, you know, panel buildings that are, like, college dorms, basically, for tech people that are going to pay, you know, $3,000 a month for a room and
for
it's
a
just
hole
like,
in the wall.
Oh man, like, what are we becoming? Yeah. So,
did you grow up here in Seattle proper?
Yeah, I grew up in like the Montlake area.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
23rd and Boyer.
So close to University District.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And it does have to be a little bit weird, like, actually growing up, spending your youth. How old are you?
I'm 34 now.
34?
Yeah.
So we're about the same age.
Yeah.
Like, when I go back to my hometown and I see, like, a new house or something like that, it's a little jarring. But I can imagine that, like, going back to your old haunts, if you live in, like, a city, like Seattle, because Seattle was not what it is.
Yeah.
Today,
totally,
you know, back in the early 80s,
yeah, exactly,
like it was not even close.
Yeah
and going back to a town or to, like, old spots that you used to hang out with as a kid, like, that must be just really, really,
it's crazy,
jarring.
It is, yeah. And I mean, even, like, you know, Cafe Vita was Cafe Paradiso when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Minnie's 24-hour diner, you know, that was just, like, where we hung out, like, and now that's just, it's been 15 different things, you know, since they closed. But it's just, you know, so for me, it's not like this anger and aggression, more as it's just like a longing for what it was. And I actually just, I'm moving August 1st down to Tacoma.
Are you?
Yeah. And the vibe there is just, it reminds me of being a kid in the 80s in Seattle, you know, it's like, it's a little more blue collar, like the warehouse district, they're like trying to preserve it. And it's close to the water. There's a lot of green.
Well, and it doesn't cost as much.
And dude, it's so crazy. Like, everything, not even just the housing, but, like, you know, fuel is 40 cents cheaper. Like, happy hour is like 20% less. It's like, did you get everything on that?
And it's only a city away.
Yeah. It's like, you know, super, super close really. But
yeah. Is that kind of a sad thing for you? Having to leave your hometown?
It is. I mean, I moved to California in my early 20s to follow music and pursue the career. So I had a little bit of a taste, but I always felt like I'll be back and Seattle will be the same. And so this time is different. It's like, I don't know that I will ever look to live full time in the city of Seattle again, which, you know, there's definitely an amount of pain that goes into that statement.
Unless
you get an earthquake.
Some insane record deal with DreamWorks.
Exactly. My favorite company.
We'll get into that in a little bit. J. Gregory, also known as Joe Gregory, joining me here in the backyard. Thank you, sir, for taking the time to come up here.
Thank you, man.
And to bring your beautiful dog with you as well.
I love her.
She's little Vox, man.
She's the love of my life.
I grew up with a boxer.
That's so awesome.
And I don't know what it is about. Maybe it's just like some nostalgic thing or something for me. But like boxer dogs are always just my favorite.
Yeah, when I texted you, I was like, oh, is it okay? Because like some people, boxers are like, whoa, dude, way too much energy, you know?
They do have a lot of energy.
They're go,
they?
Go, go. Yeah. I was very happy that you were okay with a boxer.
Oh, dude, I was totally good with that.
That's awesome.
It was, and I think I've told this story before on this show, but a friend of mine in college had a boxer. And I was messing around with her, and she was kind of a young pup too, and so just full of spit and vinegar, as a dog. And I was just playing around with her, and then she literally like punched me in the lip. and I thought for a second I must have been kind of stoned, because my first thought was like, oh right, that's why they call them boxers, like they use their arms,
right?
Like, no dude,
you no, I just got slapped in the face.
But that's it gave me a fat lip, man.
I got a claw
right on the tip of my lip, my bottom lip, and that was nice and swollen for a couple weeks.
They're strong, man.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, totally.
Sneak up on
totally.
You. Yeah.
So you're growing up here in Seattle.
Yeah.
With musical family?
No, I'm actually the only one in my family that ever, you know,
really took to it.
Yeah, I taught myself everything.
Yeah.
Guitar, piano. You know, played the saxophone in school. But yeah, nobody else in my family's really.
What was it that brought? Okay, then what was it that brought you into it then?
You know, I think when I was pretty young, I mean, 10 years old, Nevermind came out. Mm-hmm. And although I was raised in a really religious, conservative family.
Oh, you were?
Which is a whole 20-minute segment on its own. But but I was gravitating towards, you know, what was happening in Seattle at the time. And the music sure. was just so... Even as a 10-year-old, I remember just being like, oh, my gosh, this is like what life is about, you know?
Well, see, as a kid growing up over on the Kitsap Peninsula at that time,
yeah,
too,
yeah.
like, it was like Seattle was the place to be.
Oh, man. Yeah, man. It was like, it was the epicenter of everything, you know?
I wanted to be over here so
yeah,
bad.
Yeah, dude, totally. And being a kid, like, right there in the middle of it, I mean, it was like, you know, I wasn't old enough. When I was like 14, 15, I would go to the break room, which is now Chop Suey, and mm-hmm. like, they wouldn't let kids in because of the teen dance ordinance.
Yeah.
And so I would stand outside to hear Tortoise and Roadside Monument and just whatever bands I was like super into. And
yeah.
I would stand in that little alley and, you know, listen to them. And, there's just so many like memories of the Sit and Spin before they did all ages shows,
right,
like
right.
all this stuff that was just like, it just felt so electric and so alive. And because I think, you know, Nirvana gets so much credit, but it's like the songs are easy to play on guitar. And
sure.
so as a 14-year-old, you can pick up and play Polly and you know, E, G, D, and C. And
yeah.
then you can go
yeah.
from there and you feel empowered. Like I could write a song too. And so it really did kind of just light this fire of like, wow, like this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
With my life. And then from a very early age with, you know, 15, 16, I got to work with Aaron Sprinkle at GBU Studios, which was down in Inner Bay. And that was where Modest Mouse did records and 7-6-4 Hero and Sleater-Kinney. And, you know, so to be in that environment as such a young kid, it was just like, holy shit, like, this is what I want to do.
How did you meet up with Sprinkle?
Kind of just from going to shows,
yeah.
you know, and just being like always at shows and, you know, small enough group of people that are always going to shows.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of like, hey, how are you? You know, and worked up the nerve to like give him a cassette tape demo, you know, that we recorded on our
yeah.
like boom box. And yeah, we were able to make like we did a 7-inch that, this label put out. And then, yeah, it was just like on from there for me, at least personally. I was like, this is what I want to do with my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did he just like invite you to come down to the studio and say, hey, let's do something. I'll show you some stuff.
Yeah. He heard the demos that we gave him, and he was like, these songs are actually really good. You know, not just for 15-year-old kids, but like mm-hmm. they had structure and melodies and identifiable lyrics and
yeah.
things. And so he wanted to produce it. And then we had some other people that actually good friends with like Death Cab, and we were opening for Death Cab at that time when they had released their purple cassette tape and,
mm-hmm.
You know, when they first got on Barsook. And so people saw us opening for them and Peter Lyon and all that stuff. And they were like, okay, cool. We want to do a 7-inch. And then, Sonic Boom Records ended up signing the band to the first record. And
This was Delure.
Yeah.
yeah.
And so then we did that record for Sonic Boom with Blake Westcott, who did some of the Pedro the Lion records, and his brother Casey's and Fleet Foxes. And
yeah,
it was just kind of that circle. Like we, you know, the kids and it was me and Shane basically, but you know, we hung out with the Blood Brothers and the Vogue and Vade and all those kind of kids. And that circle was just like, we were all really young, but we were kind of like playing above our age and talents probably. Just kind of like owning it and being like, okay, we're going to like go on tour and like
sure.
do these different things.
Sure.
And,
so let's go back a little bit. Like, what were your parents' thoughts on this? You mentioned that they were very conservative.
Yeah. You know, it was a tough
religious folks.
Yeah. It's tough. Cause I definitely don't veer that way.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I have, some pretty intense feelings against it, you know, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I do try to respect everybody and, you know, hope that I would be respected for my beliefs and everything too.
Well, were they holding you back at all?
No, they never held me back, but it was more of a, like, we don't want you to get into this. And,
uh-huh.
you know, with this comes, you know, so much disappointment and, you know, their idea of, you know, rock and roll is like, you know, that AC/DC stands for some satanic thing or something. It's like,
right,
is pop music. This is not AC/DC. It's not like that big.
It's not Kiss.
It's not Kiss. Yeah, exactly.
You're not Knights in Satan's Service.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, so it's like that was kind of the, it was just like fear based, you know, like insecurities on that religious part, you know?
Yeah.
But I did have to hide my Nirvana records, and I think I had to hide my...
Oh, you were one of those kids.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, you know, obviously they're going to look in the underwear drawer first. Why would you hide it there? And they did, you know. But I had like a... I think I had like a Bad Religion CD, and that was really bad. And Genesis even got taken away, so...
Genesis?
Yeah, the... And Pete...
Phil Collins got taken away?
It was the Phil Collins era, too. It wasn't even Peter Gabriel. It was like, you know, the super saccharine Genesis, which I love, by the way. But yeah, it was, you know, it was difficult. And like, even when I got a major label record deal and I had a 72-page contract on my, you know, parents' kitchen counter, it still wasn't like, you know, it was a scary secular world to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it never, they're super supportive of me and they're great people. But you know, religion gets in your mind and makes you afraid of things that you don't necessarily need to be afraid of.
Yeah.
You know?
Has that relationship changed at all now?
They've mellowed out a lot in terms of that, like influence on me or trying to influence me. That I think they understand that, you know, I've, you know, grown up and now I'm on my own kind of thing.
Have you invited them to one of your shows?
No. And actually they asked, they respectfully asked if they could come to my first show as Jay Gregory.
Uh-huh.
And it was very sweet. It was a very sweet text message. But you know, I just, I go to a dark place. I really work myself up to where I was when I wrote the songs, what they're about to me. I have, you know, live burlesque, boylesque, transgender people on stage that are performing with me. And I knew that it would just make them uncomfortable.
Sure.
And, you know, and I know that they love me and that's all that matters. And
well, and you get, for people who don't know, you perform normally with your shirt off.
This is true.
Right?
And one pant leg.
And one pant leg. Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. I just had someone tell me, we're going to need you to wear two pant legs for this show. I was like, really? What? I like have it in an email. I was like, no way, dude. Is that for real? I was happy. I was like, that's hilarious.
That's funny.
It was
that's
super funny. Yeah.
And then, and then you also have like naked human statues.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
On stage with you.
Yep, yep.
Like performers.
Yeah, and they basically... they're standing still, but yeah, they're painted fully from head to toe, but wearing nothing else. So
do you think that that makes it better that they're painted? Does that make a difference?
I mean, I think to people that are afraid of nudity, maybe it seems like there's a barrier between, you know, you know, you and your skin. I don't know. I'm very chill with nudity. It's not a big deal to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't, you know, it's not a big deal to
well,
me.
Well, as noted when you came back into my backyard.
Exactly.
And my 2-year-old daughter's running around naked.
Yep.
With your dog.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, totally.
I was
totally.
Like, yep, this is life.
I don't get that, man. Like I grew up in a very small town on a beach, and it was customary for the little kids to just run around town naked.
Totally.
Like, I mean, it was no big deal.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
It's like you're naked in your front yard, you're naked on the beach in front of, you know, all the townspeople.
Totally.
Whatever. Didn't matter.
Yeah, totally.
We take our daughter over to visit some friends a while back over in Port Townsend, right? And it was a hot day, and we take Tatum down to the beach. And we didn't bring it. It wasn't supposed to be hot, so we didn't bring any swimsuit or anything like that. So we strip her down. She wanted to go in the water.
Yeah.
And she's just nude kid on the beach.
Yeah.
And people were like flabbergasted. Like the looks on people's faces that we
Yeah.
At the time, she must have been like 3.
Yeah.
Maybe 4.
And they're just mortified.
Just mortified that there was a naked child on the beach.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Oh, and it was so funny. Like she would like run up and like see something cool, and then she'd like run close to, you know, these two teenagers. And these two teenagers just like reeled in horror that they might come into contact with this little kid who was naked.
It's very over.
Very, very weird.
Exactly. I'm
very
with
weird.
You. Yeah. And for me, the statues actually have like a pretty deep meaning for me, and it's a part of the show, not just for, you know, shock value, because I don't think it's shocking.
Yeah.
But I recorded with Aaron Sprinkle, you know, when I was 15, and that was great and it was cool, but that wasn't like a major studio to me in terms of like, you know, million selling artists. And so the first time that I recorded in a studio like that I was like still really young.
Yeah.
And I was super nervous and I was like, fuck, dude. Like, I don't, and I just taught myself how to sing. You know, I wasn't really a singer. And yeah. I was like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do this. It's like the Killers had just been in the studio the weekend before doing their demos for Hot Fuss.
Right.
I had the same manager. So I did my demos that got me signed to Geffen. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in that vocal booth and, you know, and I'm drinking a ton, whiskey, blah, blah, blah. And I'm still just kind of shaky. My voice is a little shaky. I'm just like, dude, this is not good. And so I'm like, fuck it. And I just took off all my clothes. I'm like, if I'm worried about being naked, maybe I won't focus on my voice.
Focus on your voice. That's totally. That is genius.
Yeah, dude. And it worked. And like those demos got me signed to Geffen and Mark Needham mixed them. And he's worked with Fleetwood Mac and Dolly Parton. And I mean, dude, just he's a hero of mine. But it worked. And so then from then on, I performed naked, like in the vocal booth recording for a decade. Like that was my thing. Because it just made me comfortable and I was walking around the studio and everyone would be just mortified, flabbergasted, these things. Yeah. They were just like, oh, I can't believe this guy's walking around naked. It's like, dude, it's really not that big of a deal. So obviously I can't perform naked.
Right.
And so this is kind of like a part of just remembering like, you know, that fear and that insecurity and that like, oh my God, can I do this? You know, and just having that like just kind of as like a tent poles on stage for me to like kind of remind myself, like, you know, if you're afraid, if you're emotional or whatever yeah. you're going through, it's like, just remember at the end of the day, we're all just people. We're all just, you know.
So does it still make you nervous having your clothes halfway off on on stage?
No, actually now I'm like, it's more comforting. I'm like,
really?
When I get into my one-legged pant, is that pants? Yeah. I'm not sure.
I think it's singular. Singular. I think it's singular. Yeah. I think you have to have two legs to make them pants.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So once I get that going, and then I usually wear like I try to do a different like face makeup design for each show. And so like once that gets going, I really start to kind of calm down and get into my breathing and like, you know, and then I like kind of go to that place of, you know, what the songs are about and what I'm, you know, hoping to connect with the audience about. And so, yeah, nudity brings us together.
It actually does. It does. I would definitely agree with that. I would definitely agree with that. Well, let's do this. Let's take our second musical break and then come back and we'll talk more with Joe of Jay Gregory here on the Air Raid podcast. I guess we should probably mention that it's a full length, right? That's coming out? Or is it just an EP?
8-song EP.
Okay, 8-song EP, and that's going to be coming out in October.
Yep.
Right? And let's see, are you guys just shopping it around and letting industry hear it and stuff like that before you guys release?
Not really. I actually kind of don't want to do it with the label this time. Uh-huh. So I work extra days at my cafe and barista shifts, and I've just saved up to like do this on my own because, you know, I've made 3 records that never saw the light of day, never got mastered.
We're going to get into that in just a second.
So we'll stop there.
Yeah. Shut up, Joe.
Yeah, I'm done.
Shut the fuck up.
I'm done.
We'll be right back with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears. Let's see. Let's go with, we'll go with the Rare Poisons. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Cement in the streetlights. I felt time whenever I caught your eye. I remember running through the city, laughing till we cried. Oh yeah, you must have given me how else could love like this be real?
beginning of is like puny.
Me too, dude.
It scares me. Even I've turned into basically my grandmother.
Yep, dude.
Like, she refused for the longest time to get rid of her web TV. Do you remember web TV?
Man, I don't think I do.
It was like a wireless keyboard, and it was almost the size of a DVR, and it was just something that would connect to the internet, and then you'd use your TV as a monitor.
Yeah.
And it was slower than dial-up. 56K. If you can believe that.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like, I mean, you would... This is what she would do. This is literally what she would do. So she would fire it up, go do a chore. She lived on a farm, so chores take a long time.
Yeah.
and then she would come back. She would type in her password, go do a chore, come back. Let's see, search around for her email, get the email fired up, go do a chore, come back, read the emails, and then respond to one at a time and go do a chore.
Dude, it's kind of a healthy way to do it.
I think, like, that is actually the healthiest way to
yeah,
do
it. It's like,
to,
I need to
spend
do that
time on the internet
with my Facebook and shit. Like, I need to, like, step away,
yeah,
come back to what, you know?
Do you think if it took a lot longer for things to load on our phones, we'd probably be a lot more calm, right?
Dude, totally.
Or maybe, I don't know, maybe not.
I think we would, honestly. I mean, I'm having, like, a personal issue with that lately. I'm, like...
Too glued to it?
Yeah, man. I go up to the San Juan Islands, like, every other month.
Uh-huh.
And I was just like, okay, where I stay, you can't use your phone or Wi-Fi or anything. And so I was
right.
Like, okay, this time I'm not going to come back to it. I'm going to delete Facebook off my phone and just do the band stuff on laptop. And
yeah.
It lasted about 2 weeks before Ian was like, where the fuck are you, dude? Get on your fucking phone. And I was like, ah, shit. But I felt really good for those 2 weeks, dude.
It's very freeing,
isn't
it? It
really is.
Yeah.
And yeah. That's why I try to go up to the islands. Like, uh-huh. I go up there to write, but also just, like, as a recharge to, like, step back from watching Netflix, like,
yeah,
in the background, watching the Mariners. I mean, you know, it's like there's three screens going, and I'm living by myself.
Right, right.
Why are there three screens on right now? I like to party.
Yeah, man. Well, sometimes that's pretty cool too, dude. I don't know. You know, we've been, I've been going back through and watching like Game of Thrones over again.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of trying to remember who all these characters are that keep on coming in.
Yeah.
And you know, and then I'll be checking because I'm not totally invested in that whole storyline because I've seen it already.
Yep.
I'm always doing something else.
Exactly.
You know, on my phone, watching Game of Thrones on a tablet.
Exactly.
And then even checking like two phones because I've got a work phone as well. So,
totally.
You know, I'm checking email. I'm checking Facebook.
Exactly.
I'm listening to Game of Thrones.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I'm somehow I just end up stressed out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, wait,
I wonder how that happens.
Exactly. Exactly. I do the same thing with the Mariners and American Dad, and then I'm like working. I'm like, I've seen all these things so many times, but
yeah, you've seen the Mariners lose over and over again.
Year after year. I'm like, yeah, this is how the eighth inning goes.
So before we left for our first break, we were talking a little bit about you were bringing up the fact that you did have a major label record deal with Geffen Records.
Yep.
But I want to kind of get the story of, like, leading up to that.
Yeah.
Because you were in this band Delure that did some pretty great things here in the city of Seattle.
Totally.
Did you guys have much of a national draw?
There really wasn't.
At the time you were in the
band? I was only in the band from the start of it until that first record came out, and God bless Jason Hughes. But I quit the band, like, almost the day after it came out.
Because, oh, really?
You know, tensions and internal conflict, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So I wrote Jason a really apologetic email. I felt super bad, but it was just the right thing to do. So I moved down to California then. And
what? I'm sorry. What did you play in Delure?
I played bass guitar on some of the tracks.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And so you moved down to California, like, almost immediately after that?
Yeah, almost immediately. I kind of had planned my exit a little bit.
Oh, really?
And then I wanted to, like, write songs on my own and sing, and so I taught myself how to do that.
Uh-huh.
Why
LA?
So I actually moved to Sacramento.
Oh, okay.
And honestly, like, the theory at that time was, I knew a couple people, and it was super affordable to live, and I felt like I could focus most of my time on music and not have to have, you know, 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
And it was small enough that I felt like with the experience that I had with, you know, that band here in Seattle, I could really step in and like start leagues ahead. And so I started my own club and, you know, was booking touring acts. And
wait, you opened your own club down there?
So I worked at a cafe down there. Yeah. And I like, I asked the owner, I was like, can I build a stage? Can I, you know, start booking bands? And he was like, absolutely. Like, we'll get a liquor license. And it ended up being like this really cool thing. I just called it the address, which was 1020 J.
That's fucking insane.
Yeah, it was.
So like, so you're working at a coffee shop,
yeah.
And you're just like, hey, you know what we should do is just start a rock club down here in your space.
Totally.
And the dude's like, sure.
Dude, he was so cool.
We're going to get our liquor license.
Yeah. Dude, he was the coolest boss I've ever had. His name was Sergio. He was like...
Sergio's
awesome. He was so cool. And he let us rehearse in the basement where they had like the huge flower mixers.
Really?
And, like, I mean, he was just like the nicest guy and like so supportive.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it was like, it was a perfect job. It was like, you know, he paid us under the table and we, you know, I made like, you know, I worked for 5 hours and then could go rehearse for 5 hours.
Yeah.
And it was like... just a beautiful thing.
So do you think it was something like he saw something in you, like, or was able to kind of see, or for lack of a better term, kind of glom onto your vision?
Yeah, I think so, honestly. And I mean, I'm a hard worker no matter what it is. So like at the cafe, I was super hardworking and super, you know, connected with the, I want to say audience, but the customers.
Sure.
And I think that he saw that, you know, like if I said that I was going to do this, I would follow through with it.
Follow through,
and I
yeah.
wouldn't just be some burnout, you know, punk rock kid that's like, whatever.
Because that's a lot of trust.
It is, yeah. He gave me the keys to the house. Somebody. Like, seriously.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
and
crazy.
He didn't want to be there, obviously, at, you know, 11 at night when he's got to be there at 3 the next morning to
yeah.
bake. So he would let me close up and handle everything. And I was only like 21, 22, maybe.
That is a lot of trust.
Yeah,
for a
man.
21-year-old.
I mean, seriously. And I respected it, but
it's
not often that you'll run into a guy like Sergio that'll trust you like that.
Yeah.
And
so how long had you been down there before this came about?
I'd probably been down there like 8 to 12 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you'd had some staying power.
Yep.
Yeah.
He knew I wasn't running away.
Sure.
And so through that, I actually reconnected with a former contact through Delure. Who lived in the Bay Area, and I was, he asked me if I could book one of his bands. I said, hey, what's up, dude? It's me. Like, we partied on 1999 in San Francisco together. And he ended up being Braden Merrick, who found the Killers and found me before I got to Geffen.
Oh, wow.
And so
he was an A&R guy.
Yeah. So he had, he had done this company called Red Button, in San Francisco, which was like one of the first like Napster kind of sharing music type things.
Okay.
In the .com boom down there.
Yeah.
And so he had a little bit of capital, and with that capital, he like made some connections into the industry and did some stuff with Tenacious D and
really,
which is cool. But yeah, so he had enough inroads, and then he knew Jeff Saltzman and Mark Needham, who produced the Killers record and had done my demos as well. And then they knew people, Peter Paterno, the lawyers get involved, and all of a sudden you got Hot Fuss selling 7 or 8 million records.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So that was kind of like Sacramento led to getting management, which led to, you know, working with these professionals.
So what are you thinking at this time? Like, is that like, are you getting more and more excited about the prospects of this becoming a thing?
Yeah. I mean, I think at that time my head was really like, okay, I want to build this thing right. I want to do like, I really want to make music that matters to me, that I can get behind every night. I want to, you know... Growing up in Seattle, it was like, you know, Pearl Jam played a different set every night. You know, they released CDs of like every single set was different.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And I really aspired to that. I wanted, you know, the big bands here obviously led by a good example. But then you also had like, you know, Sunny Day Real Estate and other bands that had ethics and like, you know, at least you thought from a musical standpoint, they had ethics.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And if they just, they believed in what they did. And I really wanted to be that. And I thought, you know, I always used the like, you know, Radiohead wouldn't have made the Bends without Creep, and they wouldn't have made OK Computer without the Bends. And so you've got to have your Creep.
Sure.
You know, and so I was like, okay, you know, let's get in to the Geffen system or whatever. And I ended up signing through Jonathan Davis from Korn's label.
Yeah.
Which in part was because of all this.
Well,
that
wasn't
we're talking
he
about.
In Jonathan Davis is in Korn, right?
Yeah. He's the singer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he had a, an imprint through Geffen, and that's what I signed to.
Uh-huh.
Because I had, like...
Did you get to meet that guy?
I lived with him for, like, 4 months.
You lived with Jonathan Davis of Korn.
Yeah, and toured with him, and...
How weird was that shit?
Dude, it was fucking weird, but he's, like,
Is he a weirdo? He seems like a weirdo.
No, dude, he's so cool. He's like, really one of the nicest people I've ever met, and I'll never forget, yeah. we toured for, like, 2 weeks or something on his bus, and then we came home, and... He played like this K-Rock acoustic Christmas thing with, you know, Jane's Addiction and fucking Blink-182 and blah, 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 blah. And then he threw this big like off tour party at his house. And so there was just like porn stars and the whole nine yards, like literally like live sex shows. Like it was.
What?
It was like the real deal.
Shut up.
Yeah. It was real deal rock and roll star shit. And I remember like that night, like.
Wait a minute. Stop. 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 So you were at a party.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know what to expect? Like, you know that you're going to this party, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was
people putting keys into, like, glass jars or anything like that?
No, I mean, everyone that was at that party had, like, drivers or security or, you know, they had their own ways of, you know, and Jonathan's house had 5 houses on the property. So it was like a, you know, you could stay there, obviously, if you needed to.
And, yeah.
But I'll never... this is my... I think the funniest part of the story is that, like, at 4 a.m., we're like... John's sober, by the way. I'm 100% raging alcoholic at this point. Like, drinking a fifth a day, loving it. And John's like, okay, let's go get some Del Taco. And I'm like, cool, dude. Jonathan Davis from Korn wants to go get Del Taco at 4 a.m. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And so we get in the car, and it's kind of the first time that we've ever been, like, alone... where like his bodyguards weren't there and everything. And I just, I looked at him and I was like, dude, I gotta be honest with you. Like, I really don't care for the music that you make, but I really like you a lot. And he was like, I don't think anyone's ever said that to my face. And I was like, no, but I like you. Like, you're an awesome brother. You're an awesome uncle. You're an awesome dad. Like, you're a cool guy, you know? Yeah. And he, like, from that moment on, dude, we were like inseparable. Like, he was just, we were by each other's side, like, for the next...
That is, you know, so funny.
Yeah.
That's great.
And so we were working on a record at his house, because one of the houses was, like, this fucking awesome studio. And so we had, like, Tim Harkins, who had worked on Rage albums, and Ozzy, and all this stuff. He was engineering it, and Jonathan was producing it, and that was the record that I was making for Geffen that ended up getting axed when DreamWorks merged with Geffen.
Right.
So... Yeah. So that was a real tough moment, because it was like, here's this guy, Jonathan, who I really care about as a friend, and he's been so good to me. And at the time, the Killers had just released Somebody Told Me, and it was just going apeshit. Like, and my manager was kind of MIA, and I'm like, dude, Jonathan's telling me I should sign with The Firm and Peter Katsis and Jeff Quantinance and all these like huge, like, if I had done that, those dudes can just go... Dr. Dre, cool. You're going to produce Joe's next thing, whatever, you know, limitless power.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, no, I'm a loyal guy. Like, my guy's going to be there for me, you know?
And so you stuck with it. You stuck with Geffen through this, even though like industry, like pretty much high up industry wizards were telling you not to.
No, it was, I stuck with my manager who was doing Killers. Cause he was basically saying like, you know, Korn is a dead brand and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, like that totally makes sense. I mean, at that time Korn was on the decline and the Killers were absolutely the taste of the town, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, I think
we're talking like what, 2004 maybe?
Yep. Exactly.
2004?
I think it was exactly 2004.
Okay.
Yep. And so, I mean, dude, like...
That record was everywhere.
It was everywhere, dude. And, like, Elton John was, like, having dinner with Brandon. And, like, you know, I'm getting all these, like, texts and pictures and things from, like, you know, Bono's in the elevator and Chris Martin sucking somebody out. I mean, you know, it was just, like, the whole thing, you know? And so, basically, I chose my manager over Jonathan, which, to this day, I regret as a friendship thing. Like, I wasn't mature enough to like understand how to navigate business and friendship.
Yeah.
I was too young and too drunk and just didn't get it, you know? So
back to this thing that you told Jonathan on your way down to Del Taco.
Yeah.
You're skating over a lot of stuff here, man. That I've got like, questions about. I know it's your life, but we need to slow down. No, do you think you would have said something like that if you were sober?
Yeah, probably.
Really? You guys were that close?
Yeah. I mean, it was, I think it was because I felt like I needed to say it.
Uh-huh.
Like,
yeah.
I'm not into Korn. Like, the music they're making, I'm not familiar with it. The fact that they're making it, I respect that. A little Zoolander, you know? But you know, I felt like to live with him and to work on this record, he had to know that, like, I don't care about Freak on a Leash or whatever the thing was, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the statement that I made to him was more based out of, I want to get this record right that we're working on. Like, I want us to be eye to eye.
You got
to
be on the same level.
You know, it's like I wanted to have the home runs that the label needed, but I also wanted to make, you know, Jesus and Mary Chain and My Bloody Valentine and, like, you know, just cool ass music that was, you know, dark and ethereal and, like, meant something to me, you know? So it was something I would have said, you know, sober or drunk, and I was a pro drinker back then, so, you know, it
was it getting out of control?
No, it didn't get out of control. I mean, I was most people would be like in a body bag if they were drinking as much as I was back then, especially put a little blow in there and it's like you can drink all night. And but it didn't really get out of control until, like, the wheels fell off of the music train,
right.
I was just like, I mean, I have depression anyway, and with all these, like, so close and working so hard moments, you know, rock bottom for me was just, like, looking in the mirror every day and feeling like a fucking failure, you know?
Right. So how did that come about, though? So we got into it a little bit. Like you were signed to Geffen. You were working on this record. Geffen, or your management, was shoveling a bunch of horse shit towards you.
Yeah.
And then Geffen merges with DreamWorks.
Yep. And then Paulie Anthony takes over the presidency. Mm-hmm. So Jordan Schur, who had signed me, is no longer in control.
Did you have any idea that any of this stuff was going on? Like, were you aware of it at least?
No, not at all.
No.
Because, I mean, I was kind of in Jonathan Davis land where
right.
It was like, you're super protected. Like, the Black Amex weighs like a pound, you know, like, you got buses, you got gear, you got, I mean, anything.
Yeah.
And I had, you know, rental cars and money.
You're in this weird, like, rock star bubble.
Yeah. It was like, I don't know anything about Geffen and politics. And my lawyer had a fight with Jimmy Iovine over a Dre deal, and Interscope is a parent company. You know, the whole thing was just like, way, like, what? Like, why? I'm just making a record. Don't worry about it, you know? So it did, like, blindside me, but I also felt like, so I had to showcase for Iovine and try to save my ass and do all this stuff. And I ended up, like, breaking my Les Paul that Jonathan gave me for Christmas on the floor in front of Iovine because he was on his BlackBerry the whole time. And I was just like, dude, fuck you. Like,
really?
Yeah. Again, which.
So after the fallout happens.
Yeah.
Like, does it hit you yet? Or are you still just like, it'll work itself out or
exactly,
something?
Yeah. I was still under that, you know, presumption because my manager was like, dude, we're gonna get another label deal, you're still super hot, like, blah blah blah, you know, just classic LA management tactics. And so for the next 2 years I was showcasing in LA and New York,
and showcasing is basically you are playing shows for A&R people.
Exactly.
That's
so it's like
it.
4, 5, 6 people maybe in a room that's like a premeditated, like, arena stage type environment,
right? So they can see what you would look like up there.
Exactly. It's very homogenous, very...
That seems awful.
It's super awful, yeah. And it's like they try to sweeten it with, like, you know, catering and all this, like, Johnny Walker Blue, and it's like...
Right.
You can't sweeten shit, dude. It's still shit. You know? It's like, you pour Johnny Walker Blue all over it. It's still shit. So that was a real soulless 2 years of, like, not being able to really write because it's like, I don't want to write anything and have it be their property, or, like, record anything and have it be their property.
Well, and that's what happened, right?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
Because we should say the name of your old band was The Drama.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. Geffen dissolves and your records are now stuck in limbo. And you don't own them.
Exactly, yeah. I don't even... Like, you asked me earlier, like, can we play a track? And I'm like, I don't know where to find it. Like,
right.
Like, I personally don't have a
it's
copy
It's in a vault
it. Yeah, it's like, literally, you'd have to leave the studio and put the hard drives into a safe, you know, after each session. And they didn't want you listening to car mixes at that time, anything like that.
It's so fucking...
It was just fucking weird,
fucked.
Dude. Yeah, it was so fucked. So the 2 years of showcasing was just... That was, like, where it was starting to, like, really... okay, man, my soul is getting crushed here. Yeah, like, I'm really trying to be brave and strong and follow my dream.
More and, more.
And I'm drinking just like as I wake up. It's like, okay, where's the bottle? Let's get some maintenance going.
Oh, man.
So I ended up getting a deal with Hollywood. And at the time I was like, okay, I'm going to get my band like signed into this, because the Geffen deal was just me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm going to show these people in my band that I care about them and respect them and I'm going to be loyal to them. And so I gave them, you know, equal shares in the band. And went back and forth with Hollywood's legal team for 6 months, and the two other bandmates looked at it and were like, we actually don't want to do this.
Yeah.
And so they quit, and then Hollywood was like, fuck you, you're dead to the industry. Like, they were just like...
To you.
Yeah, they were like, you dicked us around for 6 months with this legal thing, and so that was a dark time.
Oh, my God.
And that was like... Yeah, that was super dark, so... We did one last trying to save grace, got a deal with Downtown Atlantic's subdivision Pulse. Uh-huh. And it was with Josh Abraham, who produced Pink and Weezer and Slayer and all this stuff. We ended up, this was again now just back to me. We had Josh Freeze come in and play drums, who's like my hero on drums. He played for Perfect Circle, Nine Inch Nails, you know, the Vandals, everybody. And so... we're still looking good, and they put it on the shelf. And they're like, we actually want to get into music publishing. We don't want to be a label. And so this is now the third record that I've made that hasn't seen the light of day. And I have, you know, my dick in my hand to show for it.
Right.
And so at that point, I felt like pretty goddamn low. And I bought a one-way ticket to Italy, cut off all my hair, and just slept on the streets and slept in abandoned churches and hung out with homeless kids that didn't speak English.
You're kidding.
And just was like, okay, like, it was a real...
Did you get sober?
No, not then. I was like...
oh, man.
It was a dark time, man, for sure. And, like, I wasn't sure if I wanted to keep going. And, you know, I was, like, questioning, do I want to keep living? Do I want to keep making music? Do I want to keep trying to make music to sustain my life, you know?
Are you keeping up any relationships at this point?
No.
I mean, had the relationship with Jonathan Davis kind of dissolved too? Like, what happened there?
Yeah, he was really upset that I... because he was saying, you know, don't go with your manager, go with me. I'll get you another label deal.
Right.
Like, you know, he still had a lot of weight. I mean, he sold fucking 40 million records.
Yeah.
Which is unbelievable on so many levels. But, you know, he was like, go with me and we'll finish making this record. I'll pay for it, whatever.
Yeah.
And so he was really hurt that I essentially turned my back on him, you know?
Yeah.
And I was just too young to know how to navigate that, you know?
Have you ever tried to patch things up with him?
I tried to send him an email a few years ago. I don't know if he had the same email.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I hope to see him again one day. I really do, because we had, like, I was so close with his nephew. Like, he had his little nephew Gray would, like, you know, want to sing with me, and I'd hold him up to the mic, and you know, his sister was so sweet, and you know,
and his sex parties were super cool.
They were super dope, I'm not gonna lie. That guy knew how to throw a party.
Oh, man. Well, I hope you can patch things up with him. Like,
yeah,
what would you say to him if you saw him now?
I mean, I think I would intimate kind of what we're talking about, you know. I would say that you know, I would apologize for not handling that situation well.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, and really not understanding life, you know, because, like, life is bigger than music, even though music is such a big part of life for me. You know, like, going to see my grandma once a week is more important.
Yeah.
You know, than some of that stuff. So it's stuff like Jonathan's relationship with me was more important than, you know, being on the hot fuss coattails with my manager.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if music never makes me another dime, I'm still going to love music, but I'm still going to have a life.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have a good life, and I'm going to be happy and healthy and, you know, all those things, hopefully. So,
do you still beat yourself up about that kind of stuff?
I did.
What happened?
I did for a really long time. Yeah. And I think, you know, that was one of the reasons I needed to quit drinking, was that just was fueling that dragon to just speak louder of, like, you're such a fucking idiot. You're a failure. Like, why did you make the decisions you made? And,
I think anybody in that position, I know I probably would have made the same exact decision that you did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely can see myself doing it.
Yeah. And I mean, I liked The Killers a lot. Like, and you know, Brandon and I hung out a couple times and I was like, dude, side project, you know, like, I mean, it was like, I'm way more into that kind of music than, you know, nu metal or whatever.
Yeah.
And that Hot Fuss is a fucking awesome record, man. There's like 8 really good songs on that record, you know?
Yeah.
I was never a huge
fan of theirs.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things for me now because, I mean, that record was fucking everywhere.
It was just everywhere.
Like, I mean, it was so, I was inundated with that record in high school.
Yeah.
And, or wait, did that come out? I was in college. I was in college.
Yeah.
But I can look back on it now and it can have like that nostalgic feel for me.
Yeah, totally. Know? Which good songs do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think you're right that most 95% of people would have probably taken the road that I took. But I'm a perfectionist. I'm methodical.
Sure.
I'm like, you know, I'm just like, why did I do this? I should have gone with, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a lot easier to sit here and say that now with, you know, 12 years of distance or whatever it is.
Yeah, well, and when you have, I mean, when you have those opportunities, like, staring you at the in the face.
Yeah.
Like, what would anybody do? Anybody would go with, like, well, you know, Jonathan Davis, you were in Korn. That's all fine and good, but these people over here are making the music that I kind of want to make.
Totally.
Like, I think everybody would do that.
And working with, honestly, like, I can't stress Mark Needham enough. Like, that guy was just, like, I mean, he's so fun to work with, and he's so brilliant. And it was, like, he was in the Killers camp.
Yeah.
And the Killers kind of, like, revived his career to a degree. He got so many gigs after that record, you know.
Yeah.
But I actually worked with Mark on 2 of these tracks, actually, Rare Poisons and E-Flower.
Oh, really?
And it was just, I hadn't talked to him in a decade, and I like hit him up on Facebook. I was just like, dude, shot in the dark, like, it's me. do you remember me? And
I puked in your shoes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, we used to go drinking after the sessions in at Cornerstone down in the valley. But he's such a cool guy, and his wife manages his Facebook, I think. But anyway, he got back to me, like, here's, or, you know, she got back to me and said, like, here's his cell phone number. He wants to hear from you.
Oh, that's cool, man.
And so I was really touched by that. And that was actually a big turning point, because when I started doing this EP, this record,
yeah,
I was still just scared as shit. You know, it's like, man, am I doing this again? Am I really, like, trying to walk into this fire again?
I would imagine that you'd be pretty timid.
Yeah.
Like, after an experience like that.
Totally. And some of, like, these 2 songs in particular, Rare Poisons and E-Flower, like, I brought to my producer, who's a long, long time friend. He used to showcase with me. I hired him to play guitar and slept on his couch when I was homeless. I mean, we're like deep friends, you know? And I was like, I don't know, man, these songs are like kind of, I don't know if they're good, you know? And he's like, what, are you kidding me? These songs are amazing. Like, we got to do these, you know? But I was just so like, I don't want to get burnt again. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
And I'm happy just making music for myself. Like, there's a ton of songs that I haven't even played for the band that I write that are just for me, you know, and I don't need anybody's criticisms or anybody's praise or anything. I just, I like to do it for me, you know? And so anyway, getting back together with Mark Needham was just like, okay, like, there's a feeling that can't be replaced by anything else when I'm sitting on a couch.
It's comfortable.
And
it's,
working with that
you
guy.
You know it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, and you hear, like, he's like, man, you know, what do you think about this? And I'm like, what? How did you come up with that? That is genius. You know, like, and it's just the room or the reflection or like something he did to the sonic quality of it. That's just like, God damn, dude, you are so good.
Well, I can tell. I mean, even just like watching you, people can't see this at home, but there is like, there's a glint in your eye when you start talking about your new music.
Yeah. It's,
and that's a really special thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, just from hearing kind of your story and your progression of how you've gotten where you're at today.
Yeah.
It's like, that's rough, man.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really rough.
Yeah.
I do want to talk a little bit more about this Italy thing, though.
Yeah,
so
how long
did you spend over there just kind of bumming around, literally?
Literally bumming around, yeah. Man, it was probably like 3 months or so. There was a death in the family that kind of shook me pretty. It was just a weird, you know, I'd always been rogue, kind of like nomadic, you know, on tour. Like, that's the life I wanted
somebody
to.
Somebody that you were close with?
Not necessarily. Honestly, it was just that it was my dad's brother, and my dad is super important to me. I love him so much, and he's such a good guy. And I remember exactly where I was on the payphone talking to him, and just like there was this tone in his voice that just like rocked me to the core.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I gotta get my shit straight. And like, he wasn't coming down on me or anything. It was just like the emotion in
You're in Italy now?
Yeah.
At this point?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Okay. I was in Liguria up northwest, and just something struck me when he was talking to me, and so I was like, okay, I gotta come back home and try to like write this ship, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
so you had spent like 3 months over there.
Yeah, just like literally.
How are you sustaining yourself?
We would like, I spoke a little bit of Italian, enough to get by with these homeless kids, and we would like go to farmers markets and like ask to like help them clean up after their day or do that kind of stuff. Yeah. I would play, somebody had a guitar, I would play the guitar, and people would throw us euros, and
yeah,
you know, it was pretty, because when I left the major league, I never really had any money. Like, even though I had these label situations, it was like you had access to things, but nothing that was yours. And
right.
If you had anything that was yours, why would you need them?
It was like all rental stuff.
Exactly. So I think that's, you know, how they want you to, be in constant recoup, you know, because then you have to go back to them for more.
Man, that's so shitty.
It's real dark. Yeah. God. Like, if you think about the basic economics of it, it's just like, dear God, like,
and it's completely unsustainable.
No, it's so awful. Yeah, yeah, totally.
I mean, the most amazing thing is that it lasted so long.
Yeah, dude, seriously. Literally, yeah. And that's part of, to answer your question from earlier, is like,
yeah,
you know, this EP, like, we're not shopping it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care if anybody at a label.
Well, now I know why.
Yeah, exactly.
You're pretty obvious.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm not going near those dudes again, you know? And it's so much better. Like Ian, our PR guy, was like, you know, when are you going to release this, the next single? I'm like, I don't know. When do you want to do it? He's like, I don't know. How about this week? I'm like, yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
Like, instead of like, oh man, I hope this record comes out anytime in the next 10 years, you know, I can actually share music with people. And, you know, we just played, we just released E-Flower last Friday, and we played Block Party on Sunday. And for the first time ever in my music career, somebody came up during E-Flower and like handed me a rose on stage. And it was like, it was just a huge moment for me, because like, I had actually released something, and someone had actually heard it. Like, I didn't know who this person was, and she, you know, clearly it was during E-Flower, which she had heard. And, you know, it was just like a real like empowering moment of, this is what happens when you, you know, take the ball back and say, look, I'm going to play by my rules. Like, I have fun shooting hoops by myself, as opposed to like never getting the ball from you assholes.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
So it was just, you know, it was a fun, I mean, Block Party was a fun experience. That's a whole other thing. But just to bring it back to like not having the labels be involved and just doing it on my own is, it's just so much more rewarding.
Well, I can tell you're very, very excited about it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I feel really, and the other thing too, is that the guys that I'm playing with right now, I'm just like so pumped up on them. Like Robert, who engineered the record, produced the record. He just did the new Band of Horses record, but he's like my long time, just dear, dear friend.
Oh, that's great.
And then Andy King on drums, just super awesome, awesome guy. And Ryan Leva is probably the best musician I've worked with maybe ever. And so the vibe, we're all just like in the same, we've all kind of been there, like,
sure,
maybe not to the exact degree of living on the streets in Italy and like puking every morning and hands shaking and kind of thing. But we've all been there, like through this like disappointment and like getting back on the horse. And that's kind of where the name Jay Gregory comes from instead of Joe Gregory. It's like, it's the concept of, you know, being passionate and following your dreams and loving what you do. And these guys embody that. So it seemed, it didn't seem right to just have it be my name, you know?
Sure.
More of a symbol, but it's so fun to like be backstage with them and roll on stage and kill a set and come backstage and just be like, these are my brothers. Like, you know, this is what it's all about. I want to do this every night, you know?
You think you're in a good spot?
I do. Yeah. I feel really good about it.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. People are responding to the music in real, genuine, authentic ways. And I'm a super emotional person. So like, it's hard for me, like after shows, I really have to like be by myself. Otherwise I'll just start crying. Like if you came up to me, I didn't even know you, and you're like, dude, great show. I'd be like, thank you so much, man. Like, it's like, what? Like, but I get to this emotional place that I'm just like,
sure,
you know, a feather could push me over the edge,
right,
you know?
Right.
Um, And so it's
I think it's understandable, man.
Yeah.
Like, you know, once again, it's like it took a lot to get to that point of like actually being ready to release something.
Totally.
Know?
And
own your own art.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a huge thing.
It's huge. So. And the first show that we played as Jay Gregory was last December at the Crocodile. And that was the first show I've ever played sober. Like, even back in the Jalour days, I was drinking and for nerves and everything, you know?
Yeah,
and so I didn't know if it would work. Like, I had no experience being sober on stage, and not just like sober. I mean, I was wasted when I would be on stage. Like,
right.
I mean, I was drinking all day. By the time we would go on, I drank 3/4 of a bottle easy, you know?
Yeah.
And so
it takes a lot of practice too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it was really like that Crocodile show in particular. We came back into the dressing room and I was just like, fuck, I want to do this every fucking day. Like, I can't believe I did that sober. I never thought I could. Like,
yeah.
I was just like, there's no way I could do this without alcohol. And to be able to do that and have the trust of those guys in the band and everything, it's just like, it's such an exciting time for me. Like,
that's awesome, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Joe, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you, man.
Yeah,
it's
likewise.
An amazing story.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. I wish all the best for you in the future.
Thank you so much.
And if you'd like to hear more from Joe, you can, visit his Facebook page, which is just Jay Gregory.
Gregory.
We'll have a link up to it at the air-raid.net. And also, you can find the songs on SoundCloud as well by typing Jay Gregory into the search bar. We'll have a link to all that stuff. Is there anywhere else that we can find you online? Can they follow you on Twitter, Instagram,
Like that? Yep, all those. And they have the same JGRGR thing.
Yeah.
So... once you find one, you can find them all.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Joe.
Thank you, man, so much.
You doing okay?
Great.
Okay, good. Well, there you have it, folks. I should have cleared my throat before I got back on there. What an amazing story. Wow. Wow. If you'd like to find out more about Joe Gregory, or Jay Gregory, as he goes by, you can type in, soundcloud.com/JGregoryMusic into your handy search bar there, or visit him on Facebook, and we will have links to those at our website at air-raid.net. Remember, folks, we are not done yet, okay? The Air Raid podcast will go on for the next couple of months or month and a half, and we'll let you know when the last episode airs. We really appreciate you guys listening throughout the years, and we really appreciate people like Joe coming on the show and just basically spilling their guts about their life and their art. And it's been an amazing journey, man. An amazing journey. I mean, just listen to that conversation that we just had with Joe. It's amazing. Wow. Where else are you going to hear stuff like that but this show, right? About your favorite musicians. Or your new favorite musicians, right? All right. I digress. Now I'm having second thoughts. Shit. I can't. I gotta stick with it. You can subscribe to Air Raid on iTunes. And if you do, please take a moment to rate the show. We're still around, so it still matters, right? We're also available on the Stitcher, TuneIn, Cairo Radio, Spreaker, and Google Play apps. Or you can just visit air-raid.net to subscribe directly to our RSS feed with your third-party podcatcher. Keep in touch by liking our Facebook page. We're still going to be using that as well at facebook.com/theairraidpodcast. Or follow us on Twitter at airraidnet. And remember to take the pledge, folks. Take the pledge to bring this up in conversation. This show. Tell people about it. We still want people to listen. It's still going to be up on the internet for probably the rest of my life. We're going to keep it going. So you can tell people about it, and they can go and listen to the archives, right? Yeah. Plus, we've still got a month and a half of new shows coming, and they will not disappoint. Trust me, okay? All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We're going to go out this week with another Jay Gregory song. This one is called E-Flower. And it's probably my favorite that he has put out so far. He's only got two songs out, which I think we hit on there. I cannot wait for you guys to hear the rest of this album because it is fantastic. It's great, great pop music. This one's called E-Flower. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. We love you, everybody. Have a great week.